This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
How is it China that was a boomer, so to speak, is now in trouble? And we're going to find out as Chris Sheridan interviews Richard Duncan, who is chief economist at Black Horse Asset Management in Singapore. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. John Loeffler here with you. What we're doing in this hour for the big picture, since Jim Poplava is on vacation, is to reprise an interview that Chris Sheridan did with Richard Duncan earlier in the month for our premium channel. What this does is give our weekend listeners a chance to hear some of the things that go on the premium channel. And if you're interested in subscribing to that, you can go to our website, financialsense.com, and do just that. This is all part of the normal weekday program that airs here at financialsense.com. Here's that interview between Chris Sheridan and Richard Duncan.
Joining us on the show today is Richard Duncan, who writes and publishes Macro Watch, a video newsletter available for subscribers at richardduncaneconomics.com. And Richard, we have been speaking regularly with you on the show in the past about some of the global concerns abroad, including the pressure that that'll be putting on U.S. markets, and a number of really interesting topics that I want to follow up with you today. One of the first things that I want to ask you, and I know that this is a series that you are currently doing at MacroWatch, is on the crisis in China. And when we spoke to you last time in 2015, you'd made some very interesting remarks talking about how it will be very difficult for China to keep their economic bubble inflated, and that you expected an average of 3% GDP growth in China a year over the next 10 years, which is quite a bit lower than the slightly less than 7%, 6.8 or so GDP growth that we see currently. If you wouldn't mind, bring our listeners up to speed with what you see going on in China and how you see things playing out there currently.
Okay, Chris. Well, first of all, thank you for having me back on the program. I appreciate that. It's nice to talk with you again. Now, China, it does seem that at long last, China's economic growth model is really slamming into a brick wall. Over the last 25 years, China's economy has been completely transformed. It's probably been the greatest economic boom in the history of the world. And they've achieved that by pursuing a strategy based on export-led growth and investment-driven growth. But now that strategy seems to have come to an end. The global economy is just simply too weak to enable China to continue growing by exporting more and more to the world year after year. Their market share is already so high to begin with that the global economy is just not large enough, and it's certainly not growing quickly enough now to continue absorbing more Chinese exports. And at the same time, on the investment side, China has such excess capacity across every industry that product prices are plunging for, I think, 46, 47, 48 months in a row now. And so the companies aren't profitable. Non-performing loans are skyrocketing, although they're probably not being accounted for correctly. And China's hit the point at this stage where the more money they invest, the more money they're going to lose. So they're really facing quite a serious crisis.
You know, it's interesting because Citigroup had just produced a report where they said, you know, we are seeing a fragile global economic recovery or expansion at this point. And a lot of that perhaps has to do with this massive amount of stimulus that China has been throwing at their economy, doubling down on, like you said, their export and investment-led growth model, which is dangerous and has long-term repercussions now at this point if they're just blowing that bubble further and further. But you know, they did cite that one of the main risks to this expansion, this fragile expansion that we're currently seeing, is China backsliding and really seeing them go through some sort of major credit crisis or economic crisis or the like. Do you think that that's what we're looking at? Do you think we're looking at a major crisis in China, or do you think that they've really bought themselves some time here?
So I've been looking at a lot of Chinese statistics over the last few days. And it's just mind-boggling how rapidly they've expanded the capacity across almost every industry. A lot of people now have heard the fact that Chinese cement production in just 3 years, 2011 through 2013, was as great as all of the cement produced in the United States during the entire 20th century. So that's just cement. Now, it may not be as extreme for every other industry, but every industry has increased its capacity by 10 times in the last 5 to 10 years at least. And they've just reached the point now where they have so much excess capacity, it's simply pointless and loss-making. Worse than pointless, it's loss-making and eroding the capital of their banking system to continue to invest more. So last year, they really did seem to try to slow down the investment. In fact, cement production fell a little bit, and steel production fell a little bit. And look what that did to the world. Chinese goods imports, the amount of goods being imported into China last year, fell by 17%. And so global commodity prices crashed, and that sent Brazil into the worst depression in 100 years and wreaked havoc really all around the world. The IMF has just recently downgraded its global GDP forecast yet again to something like 3.2%, which is pretty close to a global recession, even by their definition. And so in the first quarter of this year, things were becoming so alarming, I suppose, for the Chinese and the Chinese policymakers that they abandoned their efforts to slow down their investment-driven growth, and they allowed the banking system and the shadow banking system to increase credit in the first 3 months of the year by $1 trillion in 3 months. All of credit in the United States last year grew by just under $2 trillion. And the U.S. economy is still 70 or 80% larger than China's economy. So just in the first 3 months of the year, China's credit grew by $1 trillion. And that certainly gave China's economy a big sugar rush, and that will spill over into the global economy. It's already helped push up commodity prices, but this can't last for a number of reasons. Now, another interesting thing China has adopted recently is what I call blackmail. I believe that China has begun to blackmail the Fed up until very recently, and still the Chinese currency, the yuan, is quite closely tied to the U.S. dollar. So with the Fed intending to hike interest rates in the U.S. this year, that made the dollar move up very strongly relative to the yen and the euro and other currencies. And that pulled the Chinese yuan up with it. And China's economy now is so weak, it just simply can't endure a higher currency value. So back in August, they started devaluing the currency. I believe that was a direct threat, a direct warning to the Fed that if the Fed hikes interest rates, causing the dollar to appreciate further, then China will devalue. And that would come at a very high cost to the United States, because a Chinese devaluation would mean that the products the U.S. imports from China would be cheaper. So that would fuel the deflationary pressures in the United States. Last year, U.S. CPI increased by only 0.1%. So we were already verging on the edge of deflation. And so this seems to have been very effective. China's threats to devalue the yuan, which upset the stock market, seems to have forced the Fed now to back away from intentions to hike U.S. interest rates, which they should not have done anyway, because the U.S. economy is far too weak to withstand higher interest rates at this point. First quarter GDP in the U.S. was only up 0.5%. So China is worried, and they're beginning to take rather extraordinary measures to do whatever they can to keep their economy from going into severe recession.
So in that case, it just sounds like they really are trying to blow a giant bubble here. That's the problem with bubbles, is they don't seem to pop as soon as you would think, and they can go on for a lot longer than you would like. So, you know, I guess the big question, the looming question now, is how long this can last. How much further can they push? Can they drive a lot of the stimulus into their economy towards this export investment-led growth model? And perhaps, like you alluded to, a lot of that may have to do with the Fed's interest rate posture and what they do in terms of raising rates, or if they back off from that completely, or even reverse. So there's a lot of factors here to consider, I would say. But what are some of the things that you're looking at in specific to give you an idea of where, how things are going to unfold?
Well, you're right, Chris. These bubbles can go on for a long time, and particularly in a country like China, which does have such a tight control over the economy in almost all respects. Considerable capital controls, and they control the banks, and they can really exert a lot of influence on every person in China and all the corporations, right down to preventing institutions from selling stocks if they think the stock market's falling too much. But eventually, it seems to me that there are really two insurmountable constraints that China is not going to be able to overcome, enabling it to keep this bubble growing forever. Now, the first is in terms of financing the credit. So I mentioned that in the first 3 months of the year, credit grew by $1 trillion. Now, the credit has to be funded. It has to come from somewhere. It has to come from deposits or some sort of capital inflows into the country. Now, as long as China's trade surplus was growing very rapidly, and at the same time, direct foreign investment into China was also growing very rapidly, then there was a lot of foreign capital inflow into China, acting as high-powered money. It would go into the banking system and be lent and deposited and re-lent and redeposited, creating a money multiplier effect on a very powerful scale. But now China's trade surplus, well, it's on the financial account. That's the problem. The direct foreign investment has come down quite sharply. So they don't have the same large overall balance of payments surplus that they have had in the past. In fact, we've seen a lot of capital outflow in 2015, and that's why their foreign exchange reserves have fallen so sharply from a total of something like $4 trillion to, I think it's down to $3.2 trillion now. Now, so there are a number of things that China can do to come up with new ways to finance. For example, they have a liquidity reserve ratio. They require the banks to keep something like 16.5% of their deposits on reserves at the central bank as liquidity reserve requirements. And so they could reduce those to a much lower level, and in theory, even to zero. And that would allow the money multiplier to expand and more credit to be created. But when we're talking about $1 trillion worth of credit, a quarter, you know, the scale of this has just become so large now that it won't take very many more years before that would be exhausted. And in fact, we may be looking at a situation in China. Okay, they too would have the option, like the Fed and the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank, the People's Bank of China could also resort to quantitative easing and come up with the financing to fund this credit that way. But there's a problem with quantitative easing in China. The US and Japan and Europe can get away with quantitative easing because they're facing very severe deflationary pressures. There's a lot of downward pressure on wages in all of those places because they're having to compete with ultra low cost wages from the developing countries like China. And so the deflationary forces from globalization are offsetting the inflationary forces from quantitative easing, resulting in this point currently where there's no inflation despite a lot of quantitative easing. But in China, the situation would be different. China is not facing deflationary pressures from downward pressure on wages. In fact, Chinese wages have been going up, and China has much more of an inflation problem than the other parts of the world. So if they resort to quantitative easing in China, they may very quickly find that they have very high rates of inflation, which would be politically destabilizing, as they were back in 1989 at the time of Tiananmen Square. So that's one constraint, just the inability to continue to finance and fund such massive credit expansion for very many more years into the future. Now, there's a second constraint that I think is even more serious, though, and that's just an insufficient amount of demand to absorb all the capacity that China is now generating. So I just mentioned earlier that in 3 years, China produced more cement than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century. In fact, in those 3 years, it was 140% of the amount the U.S. produced in the 20th century. Now, so over the next 3 years, are they going to produce another equivalent amount to what the U.S. produced in the 20th century? And the 3 years after that? And the 3 years after that? Well, if they do only that, that will be 0% growth in the cement industry, because it will just be producing what they've already been producing. So if they're going to have growth in that industry and all of the other industries where they already are drowning in excess capacity. They're going to have to produce more and more. But who's going to buy it? Take Chinese steel. Chinese steel capacity now is roughly 49%. I believe it's 49% of total global steel production. Half of the world's production is in China. If they were to keep growing at the rate that they were growing over the last 5 years, it wouldn't take them long to effectively be producing all of the steel in the world. Now, who's going to buy this? The world economy is not growing, and China has too much steel. The per capita disposable personal income in China, per capita disposable personal income is $8 a day. The problem is that the Chinese people don't earn enough money to be able to afford to buy the things that they're making in their factories. So we've hit a point where the global economy is saturated. It's not growing. It's saturated with Chinese goods. So it can't continue absorbing more and more Chinese exports. And the domestic economy is more than saturated because people there have disposable income of $8 a day and can't afford to buy all of this stuff. So that's the real binding constraint. The more they produce, the more money they will lose. And the more money they lose, the more bank deposits that get destroyed. And what's the point of having economic growth if you have to pay for that growth with the destruction of savings and deposits? You essentially have growth that creates wealth, and that's not growth. So China's boom is over. And they're going to have to struggle just to keep this from turning into a very serious recession/depression. And they may succeed in preventing a Chinese depression. And if they do, it will be by following the Japan model. Japan's bubble popped 26 years ago, and they've succeeded in staying out of depression by taking their government debt through very large budget deficits year after year from 60% of GDP in 1990 up to 250% of GDP now. China is very likely to have to do something quite similar. And if they do, and if they have a great deal of luck and skill, they may achieve 3% GDP growth a year on average over the next 10 years. But that's beginning to look increasingly unlikely.
Well, you just took my next question, and that was going to be, what other historical examples can we look at to see where China may be headed? And like you said, that would be Japan, which, as you just noted, went from a low amount of debt per GDP to a very high 250%. So I guess that's kind of the expectation or the model that we should expect. If they are to successfully prevent an economic crisis and really drag this out for a prolonged inflationary kind of episode that we saw in Japan. Now, with that said, I want to go back to another comment that you'd made in the past, and that's regards to the amount of inflation that we should expect here in the U.S., and I suppose this may also apply to some extent to other economies as well, but focusing on the U.S. just for a moment, with all the quantitative easing programs that had taken place after the financial crisis and during the financial crisis, we didn't see hyperinflation, we didn't see high inflation, and you had noted that one reason for that, one major reason that we hadn't seen real high inflation take off is because of globalization. As a lot of this money was being printed, that money ended up seeping out through the very porous globalized economy that we have today. And that if we were to see globalization reverse or slow, then in that case, that may change the dynamic. Now, I think this is a very, very real risk now that we're looking at, given this huge move now we see towards protectionism, not just abroad, but here in the U.S. with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been making some very bold statements about tariffs on Chinese goods. I know Bernie Sanders has talked about eliminating NAFTA or repealing NAFTA, so that would lead to tariffs with Mexico and Canada. So we are seeing this protectionist shift, and I would take it the implication of that is much higher inflation rates in the U.S. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I think this is an enormously important question, particularly with the election coming up in November for president. It's important to understand how the global economy changed under the dollar standard. Now, back in the 1960s, when we were still on the Bretton Woods system, the U.S., well, at that time, trade between nations had to balance. That's just the way the Bretton Woods system worked. It worked in the same way the gold standard worked, trade between nations balance. So the U.S. didn't have a trade deficit. And when Lyndon Johnson started spending too much government money in Vietnam and on the Great Society programs at home, overstimulated the U.S. economy. We quickly hit full capacity, industrial capacity utilization, and also full capacity in terms of full employment. And prices started going up and wages started going up. And so by the 70s, we had very high rates of inflation, and Paul Volcker had to crush that with extremely high interest rates in 1980, causing a very serious recession in the U.S. So he brought the inflation back down again. And then President Reagan came along, and he had much bigger budget deficits than Lyndon Johnson did. But this time, Reagan's budget deficits didn't cause a new round of inflation because something very important had changed. The Bretton Woods system had ended in 1971, and the U.S. had discovered that it could buy things from other countries. And it could pay not with gold, but it could pay with paper dollars or treasury bonds denominated in paper dollars. So by the mid-1980s, the U.S. current account deficit was 3.5% of GDP, something that had never happened before. That was entirely unprecedented and shocking to the world. But by 2006, it was 6% of U.S. GDP. So what that means is that at that point, when the U.S. started having these massive trade deficits, we no longer hit the domestic bottlenecks. We didn't have balanced trade. We didn't have to rely on domestic labor or domestic capacity utilization in steel or automobile factories. We could buy things from abroad, and we could buy things from countries that had very, very low wages. And so we circumvented the domestic bottlenecks by importing things from abroad and paying for it with credit. And so we had no more inflation. Inflation's been coming down year after year ever since that time. In 2006, the U.S. current account deficit was $800 billion, $2 million a minute. So, of course, that was enormously beneficial to the global economy. The dollar standard and the trade imbalances that the dollar standard permitted for the first time in history, that created an unprecedented global economic boom that allowed Asia to be transformed and China in particular to undergo this massive transformation and economic boom. But in 2008, finally, 2006, 7, 8, finally, the Americans had so much debt they couldn't repay it. They started defaulting, and the U.S. current account deficit contracted from $800 billion to $450 billion or so now. And that's the thing that's tipped the global economy into crisis. And so it's only because of these massive trade imbalances that we've avoided inflation. And the low inflation has allowed interest rates to come down to extremely low levels. And the lower interest rates have, of course, pushed up home prices and pushed up stock prices, and have also allowed the Fed to get away with quantitative easing without causing high rates of inflation, or any inflation at all, for that matter. So now, to answer your question, if we have policies put in place by whoever becomes the next president that impose trade tariffs on China in particular, then those trade tariffs are going to result in a much higher level of inflation in the United States. And if that happens, then the bubble economy in the United States will deflate very radically. The more the inflation rises, the more the bubble will deflate. Back in the 1960s, when the CPI went above 4%, the U.S. stock market stopped going up. The U.S. stock market peaked at 1,000. I think it was 1966. And I don't think it went through 1,000 again for another 20 years until the inflation rate came back down below 4%. So this is a real danger that Americans have to keep in mind as they go to the polls. But I'm not surprised to see this protectionist backlash in the U.S. because very clearly globalization has been harmful to the majority of Americans. Wages have stagnated. Median income has not gone up. I think median income is roughly where it was in 1988. So it's very easy to understand why so many Americans are frustrated and why they've rejected the policies of the Republican Party and voted to nominate Trump to be their presidential candidate for the Republican Party. Trump is espousing policies that are diametrically opposed to those of the Republican Party establishment now going back for 20, 30 years. And to be fair, the same is true of the Democrat Party. People are voting for Bernie Sanders because the Democrat Party has been very similar to the party of the Republicans. Many people have said that Bill Clinton was an excellent Republican president for passing NAFTA, for instance, which very clearly harmed the wages and the manufacturing base in the United States, although it benefited the services industry such as banking. So now we have a situation where the rank and file of the Republican Party have overthrown the Republican establishment, and their party's been stolen by Donald Trump, who has entirely different plans. And on the other side, we're told that the majority of young Americans under 30 years old now reject capitalism and are voting in record numbers for Bernie Sanders. So the dollar standard created a very big global economic boom starting from around 1980 until 2008. The global standard boom, the dollar standard boom, is now popping, and it's having not only economic, very serious political consequences, that could become very serious geopolitical consequences.
You know, it's very interesting because speaking at the Sohn Investment Conference just recently, I believe it was on Wednesday, May 4th, there was a lot of fascinating comments made by some of the speakers there, Stan Druckenmiller and Jeff Gundlach in particular. Jeff had said that he really does think that Trump is going to be the winner. He's going to be the next president of the U.S. and that we should be preparing for a debt-fueled Trump presidency, similar to what we saw with Reagan, with a lot of the debts that were taken on. Then, and in this case, you know, he says if it's invested in infrastructure and if it's invested wisely, it could turn out well. But if it's wasted, then it's just going to be a much bigger problem. I know that this is something that you've spoken about on our show in the past, that we could go the Japanese way, that we could double the amount of debt that we have here in the U.S., which would just be alarming to most, I think, even imagining that. But, you know, if we were to go the Japanese way, then we could do that and just go from 100% debt to GDP to 200% debt to GDP. And it seems like Jeff Gundlach and others believe that that is perhaps the way things are going to go if Trump does become the next U.S. president.
Well, that may be the way things go regardless of who becomes the next president, because I do believe that policymakers in Washington, really on all sides, realize that we have a very big global economic bubble, and that if it implodes, that we're going to collapse into an extremely serious global depression like the 1930s and 1940s. And I do believe that policymakers at the end of the day are going to do, as they say, whatever it takes to prevent that from happening. And so the question is going to be how they do it. And in the meantime, for people who would like for them to do the right thing, the important question is to provide the right kind of advice on what should be done to keep the global bubble inflated. So I do think that your listeners, especially as investors, need to understand that what's likely to happen is certainly not going to be some sort of laissez-faire outcome. We're going to continue to have a government-directed economic system. The government's going to continue to keep the bubble inflated one way or the other, most probably through a combination of increasingly large budget deficits and finance with paper money creation, more quantitative easing. You're hearing more and more people now talking about helicopter money, people like Adair Turner from the FSA in the UK. And even I just read an article tonight, Bill Gross has also said he thinks QE4 is coming sometime within the next year. So we all need to have an adult conversation about how the economy should be managed properly, because the adults are not going to allow this to implode into some sort of laissez-faire market collapse and catastrophic catastrophe of depression. So going back to the possibility of increasing protectionist pressures, well, that's not ideal, as we've already described, because if we get inflation, then the U.S. bubble implodes and we're in depression. So we need to think more along the lines of, rather than how we can block imports into the U.S., we need to think along the lines, rather, of how we can get other countries to buy more of our goods. My first book was called The Dollar Crisis, and I wrote about these issues then. It was published in 2003, and I argue that when the global economic crisis strikes after the U.S. property bubble implodes, as I expected that it would, then we needed to have new policies to create global aggregate demand. How do we make global demand grow when U.S. home prices crash and the ability for Americans to borrow from their homes diminishes, which would reduce global aggregate demand. And one of the policies that I advocated was a global minimum wage. Right now, the going wage rate in the world manufacturing sector, I would say, is somewhere around $7 or $8 a day. What if Trump is a real negotiator? What he needs to negotiate, he needs to get our trading partners to agree to increase the wages in their manufacturing industry from $8 a day this year to $9 a day next year and $10 a day the year after that. In other words, a dollar a day increase in the manufacturing sector, the global manufacturing sector, would very quickly, within 5 to 10 years, it would double the purchasing power of the people at the bottom of the pyramid in the global economy, which would create much more aggregate demand, benefiting their economies and our economies, and allowing us to avoid protectionism, you know, allowing us to avoid the inflationary pressures that would accompany the inflation, the protectionism and the higher tariffs. So we need to have very clear policies that rather than reducing the global economy in a collapse of globalization, we need to find a way to increase the purchasing power of the workers in the countries that are our trading partners so that those people can buy more American goods.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think anytime you're taking more of an incentivizing approach versus a more punitive approach with tariffs, that's going to make more economic sense. The only caveat to that, I would say, and that's something that we see now with the debate shaping up for raising the minimum wage here in the U.S. And that's how employers have said, you know, if we're to see minimum wage jump up to around $10 an hour or even more, that as some candidates are proposing, particularly on the left, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, for example, then in that case, they say CFOs and CEOs of large companies say that they're really just going to accelerate that push towards automating a lot of their production. And we see this in developed economies already with this trend towards automation. So one thing that I would want to know is, you know, if we were to see movements in that direction with raising the global minimum wage towards the manufacturing base in some of these developing economies, don't you think that they would really just apply more automation and then that would just lead to more unemployment? Do you think that that is a risk to what you just advocated?
No, because, you know, in China, we're not talking about raising the wages to $15 an hour. We're talking about over the next 5 years, raising them to $15 a day. That's not going to bring about a big shift into hiring robots instead of people. And besides, in China, the policymakers understand very clearly that they have to keep their workers employed. Otherwise, politics are going to become very, very unpleasant. So they will keep their workers employed. And if they raise their wages, the only challenge to raising the wages is cheating. If China raises its wages and India doesn't, then the manufacturing jobs are going to move out of China and move into India. So we need a global minimum wage that could be enforced by the United States, the importer of first and last resort. As I wrote in my book 13 years ago, the U.S. could impose a global minimum wage by requiring that its trading partners prove that they pay their workers an extra dollar a day every year. And if they don't prove that, then we could impose an equivalent trade tariff on them so that it would make all imports equal. And in that environment, their cheating would not be possible. And there would be no incentive for any of these countries to cheat because, after all, they want to improve the standard of living and the aggregate demand of their own country. And so there is a way to do this. And that's what we should be focusing on.
I want to shift our attention towards some of the investment implications now. I noted that there was the Sohn Investment Conference just earlier where Stan Druckenmiller and Jeff Gundlach had spoken. Druckenmiller in particular had said something very interesting. He had basically said, I'm going to quote what he said, "I now feel the weight of the evidence has shifted the other way. Higher valuations, 3 more years of unproductive corporate behavior, limits to further easing, and excessive borrowing from the future suggest that the bull market is exhausted. exhausting itself. So he believes the bull market is now pretty much exhausted here in the US. And in response, he's now saying that gold is his largest currency allocation. He considers gold more of a currency play. But it looks like he's now turning bearish on US stocks and he's loading up on gold. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that both of those two points, bearish on the US stocks and bullish on gold, do you think that's a pretty safe bet at these levels?
Okay, so I'd just like to mention at this point that in MacroWatch, which is my video newsletter, I believe that credit growth drives economic growth, that liquidity determines which way asset prices move, and that the government controls both credit growth and liquidity to make sure that asset prices don't collapse. So if you're going to invest successfully, the first thing you need to understand is that we have a government-directed economic system, and the policymakers need asset prices not to collapse. They need asset prices to go higher. They don't need the stock market to go up 30% a year. They would rather see it go up 5 to 10% a year. But they can't tolerate it going down 20 or 30% a year. And as long as they have the tools to prevent that, they won't tolerate it. So yes, U.S. stocks are very overpriced, and they have been for a long time. And property prices are also becoming overpriced. And of course, the bond yields, bond prices are very high. But is this going to correct? Well, as long as the Fed has the potential to launch another round of quantitative easing, stocks may begin to correct. But if they do, QE4 will drive them back up again. So for the foreseeable future, it's very dangerous to bet that there's going to be a very significant stock market sell-off that's going to last very long. If there is, well, you know how it works. The stocks get weak, and they pull out Bullard or one of the other Fed governors to start making dovish comments, and the stocks go back up again. If that doesn't work, they'll cut the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points. If that doesn't work, they'll launch QE, and they'll launch it on whatever scale it takes to make stocks go up. The Fed has the ability to print unlimited amounts of money to the point where they could, in theory, buy every bond and every stock issued at any price they choose. So there's no question that they have the ability to push up asset prices. And in my mind, there's no question that that's what they want to do. They want to keep the asset prices moving higher because wages aren't going higher because globalization is driving them down. So they need asset prices to go higher to create the purchasing power that will keep the U.S. economy growing and the global economy growing. And so I think that even though stocks are overvalued, I think they're going to continue to remain overvalued, and they'll probably end this year above where they are now. I mean, you know, it's arbitrary picking December 31st, but the trend is likely to be higher because if there's this big sell-off, then the Fed will intervene and push them back up again. Now, this is bullish for gold, of course, because the more money the Fed creates and the BOJ, the Fed's not printing right now, but the BOJ and the ECB are printing very aggressively. So, yes, I think it is very likely that gold prices will keep going higher. But I just view gold as an insurance policy. I think everyone should have some, but I think it's a mistake to put all of your wealth in gold or half of your wealth in gold because gold doesn't have a cash flow. If you land would benefit in the same way as gold. If they print a lot of money, land prices will go up. So land is just as good as gold in that respect. But with land, you can build a house on top of it, and you can rent out the house. And you can finance the purchase of the land and the building of the house with 15-year fixed mortgages that are at record low levels. And rent out the house, and over a 15-year period, you can more or less pay for the land and the house, and ever afterwards have free eternal cash flow. So to my thinking, it's much more sensible to invest in land and houses as rental property rather than gold as a major investment. Because the land will go up if gold goes up, plus the land has a cash flow. Now, I'm not talking about buying condos. Condos are a dime a dozen. There's no limit as to how many condos can be built here, there, and everywhere. You need land to get the benefit that you get from gold, and you need a house on top of it that you can rent out.
Well, I should note that that was something that you've said on our show in the past, in prior years that you've been on our show. And of course, I do want to note that with rental costs continuing to go up here in the U.S., that has been a very good source of cash flow for investors. Of course, in terms of how that affects U.S. consumers and those who don't own a home, it's a bit of a different story. But at least from an investment standpoint, you're very right that that has been a good place to be. And even Jeff Gundlach at the Sohn conference had said that he's recommending investors to short utility stocks and buy mortgage real estate investment trusts. So that was something that he had advised. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about MacroWatch? You did kind of mention some of the basis for your thinking and how we should be investing and viewing the economy. But tell us a little bit more about your video newsletter and how our listeners could follow more of your work if they decide to.
So I've written three books in the past, and that's been great. But the problem with books take a year to write, and then the publisher takes 6 months to publish them. And so it's a very long and drawn out process. With MacroWatch, I upload a new video, a video of me. It's effectively me making a PowerPoint presentation on some important development in the global economy and how it's likely to impact asset prices. I upload a new video every 2 weeks, and each video is roughly 20 minutes long. So this has been going now for 2.5 years. And during that time, I have also made 2 video courses. And altogether, the video archive contains 24 hours of video content to begin watching immediately. And this video content, I believe, creates a very clear and easy to understand framework for understanding how the global economy works in this new age of fiat money and our government-directed economic system. And it focuses on how the government intends to manage the economy and how that's going to impact stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies. So the price is $500 a year, but if your listeners go to my website, richardduncaneconomics.com, hit the subscribe button. They'll be prompted and asked if they have a coupon code. If they use the coupon code financial, they can subscribe for $250 a year instead of $500. So that's a 50% discount. I hope that your listeners will check it out and at the very least sign up to get my free blog.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for coming on to FS Insider once again and speaking with our audience. You do produce great work at MacroWatch. I've been watching your videos for many years now, and there is a lot of great information. You dig into the details of trade, of balance of payments, whether or not we're talking about China or the U.S., and a lot of the real fundamental trends that are driving what we typically hear in the news, perhaps months in the future. So I want to give you kudos for all the great work you do. And once again, if our listeners want to find more of your work, just go to richardduncaneconomics.com. Richard, we appreciate it and take care.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
So according to Richard Duncan, China is slamming into a brick wall with their export and investment-led growth model. However, they are dealing with this problem by doubling down and pumping massive amounts of stimulus into their economy, into those old parts of their economy, as Worth Ray had said on our show just recently. And, you know, that really makes the longer term risk that much greater, because many have said that China is a epic bubble, as Richard said, even in this show, and that we have not seen this pace of credit or debt growth at such a fast level anytime in history, as we have seen with China over the past couple decades. So now they are choosing to fight the collapse of this bubble by doubling down and blowing it even bigger. So that is certainly a long-term risk. But Richard said that we may not see a collapse, an outright collapse of the Chinese economy into some depressionary-like event, but instead they may just go the way of Japan and go from 50% of debt to GDP to 250% of debt to GDP, as we do see in Japan. And that may be the long, prolonged deflationary sort of scenario that we see play out there in China. When we move over to the U.S., it's interesting because, as we talked about, you know, there's some pretty big names out there who are calling for a Trump presidency. And of course, he is now the presumptive Republican nominee, with Kasich and Cruz both out out of the race. So at this point, it's going to come down to either Trump and Hillary or Trump and Sanders. And, you know, if Trump were to gain the presidency, well, Jeff Gundlach is saying that prepare for a debt-fueled Trump presidency, that he is very comfortable with debt. And we may also see the U.S., in addition to China, going the way of Japan by ramping up massive amounts of debt from 100% GDP, like we see currently, to something more along the lines of 200 or even 250% GDP. So that's one of the things that Jeff Gundlach is warning about. And that's something that Richard Duncan has been talking about for a long time that we could do. And I think that this is an idea that many policymakers are coalescing around. Of course, as we know, monetary policy is losing its effectiveness. Positive rates are bad. No one wants to be raising interest rates in this environment. Negative interest rates are bad. And most people recognize that that's not good. So basically, monetary policy of any sort now at this point is not working and has lost its effectiveness. So the real push now is for fiscal policy measures, some type of coordinated fiscal push. I think Richard Duncan had mentioned, you know, we've seen Bill Gross now talk about this. We've seen a lot of other high-level people at the policy level talking about this. Ben Bernanke, who's been talking about helicopter drops from Milton Friedman. That's where that phrase comes from. Bernanke has been blogging about this, as we could be seeing what he refers to as money finance fiscal programs, just another way of referring to helicopter drops. So it seems like we're really going in that direction. And Richard seems to think that, you know, regardless of who wins the U.S. election, whether or not that's Trump, Sanders, or Clinton, very likely we are going to see a ramp up in debt growth here in the U.S. and some type of spending. You know, the question is whether or not that's going to be spent on infrastructure, which we sorely need here in the U.S., given that the American Corps of Engineers gives us a D-plus rating on our bridges and roads and a lot of our sewer systems and infrastructure. So obviously we need spending on our infrastructure. So it's a question of whether or not that is going to be implemented if we do see this ramp up in debt, or if it's really just going to be a matter of transfer payments, which is really what we've seen take place so far.
What you just heard here was a reprise of an interview that Chris Sheridan did with Richard Duncan on the crisis in China that aired on the Premium Channel earlier in the month for premium subscribers. And we thought we'd give you an idea of what goes on during the week on the Premium Channel, where you can sign up at financialsense.com. Next week on the program, Jim Poplava will be back for our normal format of the Financial Sense News Hour. And looking at the fact that this is the last program in May, coming up in June, will they or won't they? Are they going to raise rates or not? Will the Fed do that? A lot of talk about Janet Yellen already, but that's going to be one of the big questions as to whether or not the interest rates go up a squinch. And if they do, what does that mean for the markets and the economy, all of which we will cover here on the Financial Sense News Hour. So on behalf of Jim Poplava and all of the Financial Sense staff, I'm John Loeffler. Have a very safe, please, Memorial Day weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.